This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Finding My Voice, My Journey to the West Wing, and The Path Forward. This is the author, Valerie Jarrett. Preface. The summer sun reflecting off Lake Michigan caught my eye as I turned my chair toward the window. I was always drawn to the spectacular panoramic view of Chicago from the floor-to-ceiling window of my office on the 79th floor of the Sears Tower. Perhaps because I'd spent the first 5 years of my life living in a desert far away, I never took Lake Michigan for granted. It has always brought me peace and tranquility. The best part of my daily commute to work was driving downtown, heading north from South Kenwood along the five-mile stretch of the lake shoreline. I love water and the sun. In the summer, at our family dinners that my 90-year-old mom still hosts every Sunday, my cousins say, "There she goes again," when I keep moving my chair so that I am directly in the sun, chasing its warmth until the day's last rays sink behind our home. But on this particular afternoon, in the summer of 1987, the gorgeous sunshine and vast waters dotted with bobbling white sailboats did nothing to improve my mood. I turned my back to the office door, hoping that nobody would catch me crying. Never cry at work was one of my many cardinal rules. And yet, here I was. Who was I in that moment? Well, most importantly, I was a mom. From the moment 20 months earlier, when the doctor announced it's a girl and placed her perfect little brown body on my chest, Laura, named after both my grandmother and my husband's, had become the center of my universe. I had no idea I was capable of such unconditional love. I had also essentially been a single mom since 7 months after Laura's birth. My husband chose to move to Michigan to complete his medical residency, leaving our marriage dangling by a thread. I was also a daughter, the only child of two parents who loved each other and me unconditionally, and showed me by their example and our family legacy the value of commitment, hard work, and excellence. And I was a lawyer, the first in my family. My position as an associate at a high-powered corporate law firm had made my parents so proud, and I was the envy of many. 10 years earlier, I had ambitiously created a plan for my life based on a need for order and direction. I had this notion that by sheer force of will, I could drive my life in a rigid, linear path, and that it was somehow a sign of strength if I had the self-control to never waver from my intended course. Law school, work, marriage, baby, bliss. I pursued my plan with the single-mindedness of purpose that I'd had since I was a child. I thought it would deliver happiness. And from a distance, it might have looked like the perfect life. But as my plans were crumbling around me, I was now sure of just one thing. I was miserable. My own mother had been a professional working mom well before it was common to do so. A passionate educator who managed to pour her energies into raising me and taking care of my dad while also establishing a world-class child development research institute. And she always seemed so competent and fully prepared for the everyday challenges, so adept at what I now recognize was a mighty juggle. I never questioned that I myself would someday be a happily married, successful working mom. I'm a morning person, so normally I'm unable to stay awake past 10 p.m. After my husband Bobby moved away, I found myself awake at midnight, 1 a.m., 2 a.m. I was 29 years old and terrified to be alone. I found myself popping into Laura's bedroom multiple times a night to make sure she was okay. Being singularly responsible for my precious baby was unexpected, overwhelming, and not a part of my plan. So on that gorgeous summer day, the reality slowly crept in that my marriage bore no resemblance to the perfect one of my parents. They had each been the other's best friend And other than an occasional business trip, they never chose to spend a night apart. Alma Brown, Laura Sitter, a tall black woman, 20 years my senior, whose face showed wrinkles from both laughter and hardship, walked in my front door at 8 a.m. sharp every morning, radiating the casual confidence that comes from decades of caregiving. I'd exit the apartment quickly and then linger outside the door, waiting for Laura to stop crying, which, no doubt because of Mrs. Brown's expert and loving touch, took only a minute. But my heartache from our separation stayed with me from the minute I closed that door until I opened it again in the evening. I awoke every morning, feeling like it had only been minutes since I patted Laura to sleep the night before, with the sole goal of getting myself home as soon as I could. My workday had become a strict exercise in efficiency. Social meals, phone calls with my friends, and even occasional water cooler conversations had all been abandoned. The ache made it hard to focus. Walking into my office, I'd find my unfilled timesheets from the day before on the top of my large to-do pile. Lawyers bill their clients by time, each day parsed into 6-minute increments and recorded on a timesheet to be tallied by our billing department. That's how the firm made money. But instead of carefully logging my hours, I'd sit there each morning sipping my third cup of coffee, I always gulped down 2 before leaving home, and wondering what it was I'd done the previous day. With neither head nor heart in the work, I always ended up tallying myself short. After 9 hours at my desk, I often produced only 4 billable hours, and the work I had done was mediocre. I was not good at my job. The soft voice inside me kept telling me that I needed to change my life, but it's hard to listen to your voice if you don't trust it. Over the span of the next 30 years, my career took what many would think was a zigzag, not a trajectory upward. Some might call it a step down to go into government, but I did it as a staff lawyer and then rose to be a cabinet member for a mayor. I would be a CEO and a board chair to several organizations and always looked for ways to advocate for equality and civic engagement. Those experiences each prepared me to spend 8 years in President Obama's White House, where I was the longest-serving senior advisor to any president in history. All while I raised Laura as a single mom, marveling at how she found her own confident voice, had the courage to also change careers in pursuit of her passion, and had the good sense to marry a man who reminds me of my dad. People assume I always knew where I was going and the path I would take, but the truth is, for a long time, I knew neither. What follows is the story of how I found my voice and learned to trust it, a voice that went from barely audible, even to me, to one I hope has been a catalyst for change and has been a source of strength and empowerment for others. My journey has been exhilarating, challenging, and yes, at times very painful. But what an adventure. Chapter 1. The Gift of Freedom. My earliest memories are of my childhood in Iran. Like everyone, I've no doubt blurred my actual childhood memories with stories recounted by my parents and my own vivid imagination. But my recollection of my first 5 years is that they were perfect. I was born in Shiraz, a city over 4,000 years old, known for its beautiful gardens and for being the home of artists, scholars, and poets during the height of the Persian Empire. My mother recently reminded me that it actually snowed in the winter, but all I can remember is blue skies and warm, bright sunshine. The gated community where we lived was a compound for the families of 30 or so doctors who worked at the hospital, many of whom came from all over the world. We lived in a comfortable 2-bedroom bungalow, surrounded by trees and flower beds. There was a park with tennis courts and a huge swimming pool. Every year in December, we'd cut down a Christmas tree from a large patch of nearby woods. We even had a small zoo on the compound with mountain sheep, goats, a bear, and a jackal, which was allowed to roam freely around the compound and was known to take toys and hide them from time to time. I felt I had all that I could possibly want or need in that special place. Even at the age of 3 or 4, I was allowed to explore as I chose, always under the watchful eye of Soroya, my nanny, and our family's housekeeper and cook. Soroya was small, barely 5 feet tall, gentle, and kind. She had a son of her own whom she left with her mother during the day while at work. We were always joined on these walks by our Belgian shepherd, Dovum, who I nicknamed Dodi. One time I fell down in the street. A passerby saw me crying and approached me to see if I was okay, only to have Dodi snarl and keep him at bay. Someone ran to find Soroya, and she came, whisked me up in her arms, and took me home, with Dodi following dutifully behind. They were my protectors. The pool was my favorite place of all. My mother taught me to swim before I could walk, and I loved diving and splashing about in the deep end for hours and hours. My parents had a good friend, Tom, whose real name was Thelma. She headed the Iran-American Society, and her husband, Dale, was an engineer with Point 4, an American Foreign Assistance Program. Tom did all sorts of activities with me, like taking me to a local preschool. She encouraged me to practice English with the young Iranian students who were trying to learn the language, but I would speak only Farsi, an early sign of my long-standing desire to be like everyone else. It was in the pool, though, that Tom and I had the most fun. She'd put me on her shoulders, then she would climb on Dale's shoulders, and Dale would slowly walk down into the deep end until we were all well submerged. Then I would pop up to the surface, laughing and coughing from swallowing water. Once Dodi, always my bodyguard, spotted our circus act and tried to rescue me by diving in the water. Chaos ensued, as dogs were strictly forbidden in the pool. Outside the compound, my parents and I often explored the city and the surrounding countryside. My best friend was Roshan Farooz, an American-Iranian girl about my age. Her parents, Narsi and Louise, were my parents' best friends, and we were inseparable, running around together at one of the two Farooz farms, Big Lou and Little Lou, both named after Louise and their relative size. Roshan was scrappy and forever coaxing me into mischievous adventures. They had a huge donkey, Laura, and we'd climb up on her and ride her around and play endless games of make-believe with all the different farm animals as the characters in our stories. My parents and I traveled all over, but one of our favorite day trips was to the ancient Persian city of Persepolis, where I'd climb up and down the old stone stairs, running circles around the columns, and hide among the monuments. Either we'd pack a picnic lunch for the day, or my parents would take me to a hotel nearby for a treat. An afternoon entertaining myself among the ruins, topped off by a delicious dinner prepared by Soroya back home, made for a day I still treasure. Soroya did all our shopping and made all our meals. While kids my age in America were eating hot dogs, Oreos, and peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, I was devouring her lamb, rice pilaf, and the cool cucumber and yogurt of Mastakhiyar. She cooked with saffron, cumin, and dried barberry, spices we'd buy when she took me to the Vakil Bazaar in the old city. I loved to smell all the fragrant and colorful spices heaped in copper pots and burlap sacks. When I traveled the world as an adult, particularly when visiting different bazaars and markets throughout the Middle East, the familiar smells always take me back to those early years and make me smile. To this day, I still love all Persian food except eggplant. But my favorite dish is any kind of rice. No meal in my home is complete without a serving of rice. After we moved back to America, it took me until high school to develop a taste for a good hot dog at a baseball game. And it was only a few years ago that my daughter convinced me to try peanut butter. Not bad. Iran may have been a magical place for me as a child of a Western doctor, but that certainly didn't mean Iran was a magical place for everyone. Mohammad Reza Shah, the last Shah of Iran, had pursued many modernizing reforms, among them the improvement to the healthcare system that had built the hospital that brought us there. but he was simultaneously a brutal dictator who established the SAVAK, the secret police force that terrorized dissidents and disappeared people at will. I'm often asked why I was born in Iran. My father once said I should tell people because that's where my mother was at the time of my birth. But that answer never seemed to satisfy anyone, particularly border guards and customs officials. The truth about why we were in Iran is somewhat complicated, but what it boils down to is really quite simple. We were there because my father was black and he needed a job. I arrived in this world just as the American civil rights movement was gaining momentum. The rights and opportunities for which black people were marching and fighting in the United States, my parents and I were privileged to enjoy in Iran. While many black families were often confined to redlined slums, we had a lovely house in a cosmopolitan neighborhood. While black people in America were marching for the right to enjoy public pools and parks, our neighborhood had lush green spaces where I could run and play, and a big swimming pool where people stared only when my dog jumped in the pool with me. While black students in the United States had just begun to be bused into hostile white neighborhoods to integrate the schools, I attended an excellent school with loving teachers, filled with kids from all over the world. The freedom of mind that I had always known and that had taken my father 30-odd years to achieve was the same freedom that brave little children my own age had risked their lives to attain. Children like Ruby Bridges, who at age 6 in 1960 was the first black child to desegregate the all-white William France Elementary School in New Orleans. I met Ruby Bridges 51 years later when President Obama invited her to the White House to view the famous Norman Rockwell painting of her walking to school, hair perfectly combed and wearing a starched white dress, escorted by large armed guards. I told Ruby in the Oval Office that I was in awe of her courage and bravery at such a young age, and that she had fought for a freedom that I took for granted. My father, Jim Bowman, had always wanted to be a doctor. He grew up in Washington, D.C. in the 1930s and 40s. In D.C. in that era, his life experiences were determined by the color of his skin, including where he could attend school. Living in D.C., however, meant he was relatively fortunate. The son of a prominent dentist in the city's small black middle class, he was able to attend Dunbar High School, the premier high school in Washington and perhaps the country for black Americans at the time. As oppressive and unjust as segregation was, it did mean that black scholars with PhDs from Harvard and other Ivy League schools often had no choice but to teach at the high school level, at schools like Dunbar. So at a time when few black children had access to quality schools, my father's education was first rate, and the lessons stuck. His grammar was impeccable, and he corrected mine throughout my life, even when it made me sound ridiculous. I used to ring the doorbell when we visited my grandmother, and when she said, "Who is it?" I wasn't allowed to say, "It's me." I had to say, "It is I." All that was missing was hark. Graduating at the top of his class at the age of 16, my father went on to Howard University for undergraduate and medical school, the famous historically black university in D.C., and his own father's alma mater. Had my dad chosen a different career, he might have found more doors open to him. But as the civil rights movement began making inroads across the color line, medicine would prove to be one of Jim Crow's most tenacious holdouts, which is unsurprising given the intimate nature of doctor-patient relationships and the pervasive racist myths about black people and disease that kept us from sharing swimming pools, let alone hospitals, with white people. Desegregation in healthcare didn't begin in earnest until the passage in 1965 of Medicare and Medicaid, programs that threatened to strip federal funding from any hospital that engaged in racial discrimination. When my dad graduated from medical school in 1947, he joined D.C.'s Freedmen's Hospital for a one-year residency. During that year, his mother, only 38 years old, died in Friedman's from hypertension while he was on duty. In a quiet moment of openness, he once shared with me how helpless and guilty he felt that he could not save her. From Friedman's, he was offered a huge opportunity, a residency at Chicago's prestigious St. Luke's Hospital. He was the hospital's first and only Black resident. After only attending all-Black schools, he was thrilled to break the color barrier, but even then, the door opened only partway. He wasn't allowed to live with his white colleagues in the residence quarters adjacent to the hospital. He had to find room and board on the south side of town where Blacks were allowed to live, 5 miles away from the hospital, and travel by bus or streetcar, a very long and tiring commute after a 36-hour shift. He was also instructed to enter the hospital through the back door. This he refused to do. He showed up on his first day and he walked right through the front door like all the white doctors. Word of his act of defiance spread quickly through the Black staff. The next morning, many of them were waiting out front when he arrived, and they all walked in together. Nobody objected. Chicago was like that. It had a patchy attitude towards segregation. Some freedoms were allowed, some weren't. Marshall Field's, the famous department store, was a classic example. Black people could shop at Marshall Field's, but they couldn't work there. It was a checkered landscape that my mother's family had learned to navigate. Through education that led to financial stability, they became one of the most politically connected Black families of the time, carving out a measure of status and access unavailable to most Black Chicagoans. They and others in the Black middle class built their own businesses and social network, but they were second-class citizens nonetheless, and their relative degree of freedom existed in a very narrow lane. For my mother, Barbara, there was no equivalent to Dunbar High School. In Chicago, all Black schools offered second-rate educations. Fortunately, her father, Robert Roshan Taylor, was a leading figure in Chicago's business and civic circles, even outside the Black community. He came to prominence through the city's real estate, banking, and insurance industries, which led to his appointment as the first Black chairman of the Chicago Housing Authority in 1941. Thanks to his prominence, he was able to obtain special permission from my mother and her older sister, Laurenita, to leave their all-Black neighborhood and travel to the then-white neighborhood of South Inglewood to go to its all-white elementary and high schools. That put her on the path to attend Northfield School for Girls, an elite prep school in Massachusetts, which in turn opened the door for her to enroll at a small, predominantly white women's college, Sarah Lawrence, in Bronxville, New York. During trips home from college and after my dad flubbed a blind date with her sister, my mother and dad started dating and soon fell in love. After my dad proposed and my mom accepted, they knew they first had to get past her father, who had strong opinions on priorities and his family. And so, in a story that he would tell many times over the years, with embellishments added over time, no doubt, my dad came up with an ingenious strategy to get his way. Over a game of bridge one evening with my mom's parents, my dad took an extra long time to study his hand, and then, when he finally played his card, he casually tossed in, "By the way, Barbara and I are getting married." It was classic Jimmy Bowman, deliciously provocative, with perfect comic timing. But this was no joking matter. A bit flabbergasted, my grandfather finally replied, "But you know, Barbara has to finish college first." "That's good," my father said, "because I can't afford to pay her tuition." And so my parents were married on June 17, 1950, 2 weeks after my mom graduated from Sarah Lawrence. My dad finished his residency that same year, but despite his sterling credentials, he still enjoyed limited job prospects. In most major cities, even the segregated ones, Jim Crow hospitals that served Black patients were often white-owned and refused to hire Black doctors and nurses. With few options to choose from, my father accepted the position of chair of pathology at Chicago's Provident Hospital. Established in 1891, it was the first Black-owned and operated hospital in the United States, and as such, one of the only places that would hire him. While at Howard, my father had joined the Army ROTC, graduating as a second lieutenant, and as the Korean War escalated in 1953, the Army called him up and stationed him at an Army hospital in Colorado, where he and my mom lived for 2 years. Upon being honorably discharged in 1955, he told my mother he didn't want to return to Provident, or, as he put it, anything that smacked of segregation. He applied to the United States Public Health Service, which offered him a job in Liberia. But the ambassador to Liberia, who was a friend of my parents, told them, "Do not, under any circumstances, come here. It simply wasn't safe." Then, when it seemed like Provident would be the only viable option, a white colleague of my father's was offered a job as a chair of pathology at the Namazi Hospital, a newly constructed facility just staffing up in Shiraz, Iran. He declined the position but passed along the contact information to my dad. Iran, which is a little less than 7,000 miles from the south side of Chicago, had certainly never been on my parents' radar. But after many lengthy discussions, my parents decided that it would be the adventure of a lifetime, a chance for them to be alone together, away from all that was familiar, including the racism and discrimination they'd endured their entire lives. So my father applied and received an offer. When my parents announced to family and close friends that my dad was considering the job, nobody was shocked since many knew that they wanted to go abroad, but my grandparents wanted to keep the family close, and this was too far away. However, my parents had made up their minds, and so he accepted the job, and off they went. The day my parents boarded the plane for Iran, a country on the other side of the world, they didn't speak a word of the language, knew not a soul or anything about the nation, its government, its culture or customs, beyond what they learned from the Encyclopedia Britannica. Nothing. All they knew about this strange and exotic place was that it was willing to give a black doctor an opportunity far better than any available to him in the country where he was born. Which is how, on November 14, 1956, after a very challenging labor and a risky high forceps delivery, as my mother frequently described it during my youth, much to my embarrassment, I entered this world, the second baby born at the Namazi Hospital. I was always relieved that they'd practiced on one other baby first. Had I merely spent those first 5 years of my life in Iran, that would have been adventure enough for a lifetime. But from there, my father's career really took off. Trained as a pathologist at Namazi, he became interested in genetics, and in particular, favism, a genetic blood disorder that produces an allergic reaction to fava beans. It's caused by an enzyme deficiency, and being hereditary is common among certain ethnic groups in Iran. What followed was his lifelong study of inherited blood diseases through the Middle East, Africa, Mexico, and America. His work in common enzyme deficiencies later proved important to the larger field of inherited diseases and minority health. Starting in Iran and parts of many summers of my youth in the years to come, we traveled the world collecting blood samples for genetic testing. We went to remote deserts, dense cities, rural villages, isolated rainforest jungles, the constant blur of new places, people, customs, and food. All seemed perfectly normal to me. My parents left me with babysitters every now and then, but mostly I was by their side, perfectly content to label blood vials and give out Band-Aids for hours anywhere from Nigeria's jungles to rural communities in Mexico. My mom likes to tell a story that happened when I was 9 years old and we were in Ghana. She'd given me a little money to spend on the trip. She looked out the hotel window to see me squatting with the street vendors selling tourist trinkets. Having learned in Iran, I could stay in that position with the best of them. And bargain, too. I returned an hour later, happily carting an armload of souvenirs that I'd secured with my excellent negotiating skills. Skills that would later serve me well in the political worlds of Chicago and Washington, D.C. We went everywhere and did everything. While I was still in diapers, we drove nearly 4,000 miles from London to Shiraz, flying only over the English Channel. In Russia, my father made me try caviar, which I loved, and he took me to Lenin's tomb, which I absolutely did not. In Egypt, I delighted in riding camels past the Sphinx and the Great Pyramid, and in India, I was mesmerized by snake charmers and water buffalo under the towering spires of the Taj Mahal. In Uganda, our plane touched down in the middle of a military coup after curfew, and my parents had to convince armed soldiers to wave us through numerous checkpoints to reach our hotel. In the villages of Yucatan, I brushed my teeth with soft drinks and I ate peppers so hot they seemed to set my mouth on fire, which I tried to wash down with a big swig of Coca-Cola, something you should never, never do. One story, which became an oft-repeated tale about my dad, took place in Mexico City. We awoke in the middle of the night to find our hotel swaying like a ship at sea. I felt slightly nauseous from the motion, and I asked my mom what was happening. "An earthquake," she shouted, a rare time that I remember her ever raising her voice. My mother grabbed my hand, and we ran for the stairs to the lobby, calling back to my father to hurry up. "I'm right behind you," he said. It was madness, people running down the stairs into the lobby in their underwear, screaming in fear. My mother and I waited in the lobby a good 20 minutes, and only then, right after management had given the all clear, did my father appear, having taken the time to neatly dress in his robe, pajamas, and slippers, casually emerging without an ounce of concern. I think he might have even taken the time to shave. The next morning, the parking lot was empty. All of the tourists had decided to abandon their plans and evacuate. My parents simply laughed. A mere earthquake, even one that had left electrical wires dangling in the streets, would not intimidate them. I had always known my father as a confident, fearless, and cheerful, a glass-half-full type person. But before living in Iran, that natural exuberance had always been dimmed by the brutal realities of Jim Crow, by the limitations on what he would be permitted to achieve, the constant blatant and subtle reminders that he was considered less than because he was black, a belief that he had internalized as so many marginalized people do, even though it wasn't true. But after his experience in Iran, and certainly by the time we started to travel the world for his research, he had emerged from the cloud of his own limitations. He felt liberated. Outside of the United States, and in his own mind, he was no longer defined by the color of his skin. He was no longer a colored doctor. He was simply a doctor, a respected chief pathologist, a published academic. His self-confidence had grown along with his reputation. He'd experienced success based on merit and hard work, just as my mother had years earlier by the time she graduated from college. And thanks to both of them, I grew up believing that was possible. It's much easier to be what you see. My parents were my role models, and they gave me the early impression that my potential in life was limited only by my willingness to work hard and be resilient, combined with a good bit of luck. My mom and dad had taken me across the color line and around the world, showing me what was possible, so that I could dare to imagine any kind of life I wanted. It was only years later that I truly understood how lucky I was. I'd been given that freedom as a gift from birth, so even after moving to Chicago, where the laws and social customs still tried to curtail opportunities for black people, in my mind I was already free, and no one could take that away from me. The segregation in the United States that my parents had left behind in 1955 was still alive and well when we returned in 1961. Still, they were homesick. My mother's father had died when I was only 6 months old, and we'd missed the funeral. My mother was very close with her family, and she wanted me to know them. They always knew we'd leave Iran eventually. It just so happened that I was the one who hastened their decision along. Iran had massive inequalities of wealth and a rigid caste system. Those who were wealthy were very wealthy and lived very well. Those who were poor lived in unspeakable conditions. I can vividly remember seeing people with severe disabilities begging on the streets, shunned by society, and with no means of support and no place to go. Those in the lowest caste who were lucky enough to have jobs often worked as servants, and it was socially acceptable to abuse and beat them. Soroya was a member of that class. 28 years old, she had only a sixth grade education. I loved her dearly, but as I neared age 5, I showed a sign that I had begun to internalize the mores of Iran's caste system as my own. My mother walked into the house one afternoon to see me giving Soroya a swift kick as hard as I could, probably because she told me I couldn't do what I wanted to do, though I do not remember exactly why. Horrified, my mother immediately swooped in, gave my rear end a rare swat, and said firmly, "No, Lally." That's the nickname I gave myself at a young age when I could not pronounce Valerie. Now it was Soroya's turn to be horrified. She turned to my mother and said, "Why did you do that?" "Because she kicked you." "No, no," Soroya said, "it's fine." "No," my mother replied, "it's not fine." Soroya then went on to explain that she thought it was okay for us to kick her and beat her whenever we liked. She knew that was her place. She was grateful that we let her work in our home, and she was scared that we would think that she thought she was above her station. My parents had never adopted Iran's social norms as their own, and they'd always treated everyone with respect, no matter their standing. Having grown up under Jim Crow in America, for them to see their daughter behaving the way I had was totally unacceptable. That night, as we sat down to dinner, my mother turned to my father and said, "I think it's time for us to head home." Chapter 2. Inheritance. "Hey, you! Hey, Red! Turn around!" I recognized the voice of the girl yelling behind me instantly. It wasn't hard. I heard it all the time, since bullying me was her favorite after-school activity. She kept on yelling, but I didn't turn around. Instead, I kept walking, trying to ignore her and the familiar queasiness growing in my stomach. I lived only 4 blocks from school, but I had learned from past failed attempts that I couldn't outrun her. So I braced myself, knowing what was coming. Then it came, a hard shove from behind. I tumbled forward and went down on the pavement with a thud. Welcome to Beulah Shoesmith Elementary, South Kenwood, Chicago, 1962. Shoesmith was a rough experience for me. Predominantly black student body, overcrowded, struggling teachers, mostly good kids, but more than a few tough kids as well. I was a fair-skinned, freckle-faced, red-haired 5-year-old placed into a second-grade class with kids nearly 2 years older than me. I spoke with a British accent, and none of my classmates had ever heard of Iran. I didn't understand the slang the kids used, and I didn't know much about the customs or the culture, all of which no doubt made me a likely target for bullying. Splayed out on the sidewalk in front of school, books scattered, I slowly pulled myself to my feet, fully prepared to be knocked down again, when I heard another voice. "Leave her alone." It was my younger cousin Lauren, coming to my rescue again. Lauren was 7 months younger and 10 pounds lighter than I, but she had a well-deserved reputation as a mighty tough fighter. Maybe because she was the youngest of 3 kids, she had learned how to protect herself, and thankfully me. The bully backed away while Lauren helped me gather my books. It was humiliating to rely on my younger cousin for protection, but I was relieved to escape with nothing more than a couple of bruises on my knees and my ego. The transition from Iran had not been easy. Our path home to America had taken a year-long detour through London, where my father was awarded a fellowship in genetics at the Galton Laboratory of University College London. After living a carefree life in a world full of sunshine, bright colors, and best friends, I was dropped abruptly in the middle of a strange, mostly gray place known as Muswell Hill, a quiet, stodgy, middle-class neighborhood in London. I'd left behind Soroya's warmth and indulgence, for the cold indifference of our new housekeeper, Mrs. Baldwin, who was not unkind, but made it clear that I was an unwelcome bother. Living in London was, for me, the beginning of a retreat into shyness that would last well into adulthood. London was not an adventure like our other travels. It was supposed to be home, but to me, my home was Shiraz. Facing this strange new world, I pulled back into a shell. The first few months of school, I was too embarrassed to raise my hand in class to ask to go to the bathroom, preferring to sit in wet bloomers rather than draw attention to myself, a problem that was solved only when my mother made good on a threat to spank me if it happened again. My fear of her discipline was greater than my fear of speaking up in class. A year later, the move to America was also hard for me and my dad. Discrimination in the medical profession had scarcely improved, and despite enthusiastic recommendations from many white colleagues, most major hospitals still refused to open their doors to a black doctor, even one as qualified and experienced as my dad. But he kept knocking on doors, and through some combination of perseverance, talent, charm, and just plain luck, while delivering a paper at a genetics conference in Mexico, my father managed to meet and impress the dean of the University of Chicago Medical Center, who invited him to become the school's only black faculty member. The south side of Chicago, where my mother had grown up and was so familiar to her, was also home to many in my large extended family, home to everyone but me. And that left me at the mercy of the bullies at Beulah Shoesmith Elementary. Being different was uncomfortable for me. I just wanted to fit in and be like everyone else. All my family and new classmates said tomato while I said tomato. I dropped the British accent in less than a week. Despite knowing French and Farsi, I refused to speak any language but English. My mother was so proud to have mastered a new language. She often spoke Farsi when we were in public, and she didn't want people to understand what she was saying. But when people turned to stare, I would plead with her to stop. Another characteristic that I tried to change was my hair. Nearly everyone in my family had long, thick hair, some curly, some straight, historically referred to by some in the black community as good hair. Everyone but me. As soon as my grandmother, Puddin' we all called her, thought I was old enough, she told my mother I had outgrown the hot comb used to temporarily iron out the coarseness of my hair, and she took me to the salon where they straightened my hair with chemicals. I still remember smiling with pride as I looked at myself in the mirror and saw my nearly shoulder-length hair bouncing when I turned my head from side to side. My look then conformed to what I had envied in others and to what society told us was pretty. It was not until several years later, during the Black is Beautiful movement, that the definition of pretty began to evolve. But even today, many within the Black community still struggle to embrace a broad and inclusive definition of our beauty. One characteristic that I could not change was my skin color, a factor that would prove confusing throughout my childhood. I had a brown-skinned friend who used to say everyone in my family was light, bright, and damn near white. An overstatement to be sure, but her tone left me wondering, was that supposed to be a good thing or a bad thing? When we left Iran, my parents had told me that, in addition to worrying about the cultural differences there, they wanted us to return home so I could grow up with a better understanding of my identity as a black person, which would have been hard to do in Shiraz since we were the only blacks from America who lived there. Yet one of the many reasons why I was bullied by the black girls at Shoesmith was because of my fair skin. If this was supposed to be my community, I wondered, why am I treated poorly? As I grew up, I came to understand that slavery had produced a caste system that left deep scars, separating blacks based on color. Those with darker complexions often faced worse treatment than those with lighter skin. And nearly 100 years later, growing up in Chicago, the vestiges of the harsh color line and the discrimination it produced triggered both resentment and envy within the black community. It also meant that those who had the ability to situationally or even permanently pass for white had a choice to make. One of my early memories is getting all dressed up to go to see the fabulous Christmas decorations at Marshall Field's with Puddin'. We stopped for a delicious chicken salad lunch at the magnificent Walnut Room, the department store's famous restaurant. Although I was oblivious to it at the time, I was later told blacks were not welcome there. But Puddin', fair-skinned with dead straight hair, and I blended right into the all-white room. No one was rude or treated us poorly. Other than the black servers who gave us knowing glances, no one there knew we were black. When I was young, we never discussed it, but being there was a privilege only those as fair as Puddin' and I could pull off. Our presence there was a confounding decision I wrestled to understand as I grew older. Puddin' did not live as a white woman, as some fair-skinned blacks in her generation chose to do, but she wasn't interested in drawing unnecessary attention to her race. She never once made me think she wasn't proud to be black. In fact, her social circle, other than some of her husband's business associates, was almost entirely black. Yet, she also never explicitly acknowledged the comforts of life she chose to enjoy as a result of her complexion. That day in Marshall Field's, I imagined she simply wanted to give her granddaughter a special experience. But looking back, I wonder if she felt more conflicted than I knew about how she navigated her decision to go where others could not. Puddin' and my mom often told me stories of their family trips to Tuskegee, Alabama, to visit my great-grandfather. They would drive from Chicago and spend the night in friends' homes along the way. But one time they passed through a southern town where they knew nobody, and there were no hotels that allowed Negroes to stay. So my grandmother, the fairest in the family, checked into a whites-only motel, leaving everyone else in the car. Then, when the clerk was not looking, my darker-skinned grandfather and their two daughters sneaked into their room. They described it to me as a convenience, but it was also a privilege. My first memory of encountering racism is from the age of 10, when my parents sent me to an all-girls sleepaway camp in Michigan. I was the only black girl there, and on the very last day of camp, as I was packing up my clothes, this one girl with whom I had become good friends started talking to me about what a fun time we'd had. And then, out of nowhere, she suddenly blindsided me by blurting out, "You know, I thought you were a nigger when I first met you. I'm really sorry." I froze. My face turned bright red. Did I want to lash out in outrage? Nope. All I wanted to do was to get out of there as fast as I could. In my overactive imagination, I pictured myself saying, "Oh, but I am," only to have her beat me up the way the black girls had done 5 years before. So I didn't tell her the truth. I just mumbled something like, "Oh, that's too bad." Then I finished packing and was anxious to leave. I never mentioned it to my parents or anyone else. I was too ashamed. 50 years later, I'm still embarrassed that I let her insult me that way without confronting her and telling the truth. But in the moment, it felt simpler to go along rather than give voice to my outrage. For most people of color, there are circumstances when putting up with those random acts of racism is easier because the fear of the consequences of speaking out will be even worse. Whether it's at school, at the office, our criminal justice system, or in politics, being outspoken about racism always risks a backlash. That fact, coupled with my natural shyness, meant that my default response to racially tinged situations was to keep quiet. The following summer, I went back to the same camp, only this time my cousin Lauren, who is brown-skinned, came with me. With Lauren by my side, there could be no sidestepping the fact of our race. And, sure enough, one day someone called her a nigger. I knew that I had to defend her because when we were younger, she always stood up for me, but I was paralyzed by the thought. Luckily, before I could even think of how to respond, a friend of ours, a big, burly white girl, stepped between us and the bully and pushed her off. "Don't you ever say that to her again," she said, threatening the other girl. Thank God, I thought, grateful that she'd stuck up for us. Since I was so painfully shy and scared to speak up for myself or for others, it would be a years-long struggle for me to find my voice. But I drew strength from my parents and also from the stories about the struggles and accomplishments of so many other members of my family. My family's story, or at least one chapter of it, began in the port city of Wilmington, North Carolina. My great-great-great-grandfather, Angus Taylor, was white. He owned my great-great-great-grandmother, an enslaved woman whose name I do not know. In 1823, she had a son by him, Henry, who was freed at the end of the Civil War and would go on to live and work as a carpenter in Wilmington. Henry's son, Robert Robinson Taylor, was born in 1868 in humble beginnings, but because Henry believed that the path to a better life depended on a good education, he encouraged Robert to study hard and look beyond Wilmington for opportunities. Robert did so well that he crashed through a racial barrier and became the first black student to attend the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Boston. The tuition, a fortune at the time, was paid out of the $5,000 his father had saved from his carpentry wages. After graduating in 1892, Robert Robinson Taylor went on to become America's first accredited black architect, hired by Booker T. Washington to design many of the buildings on the campus of the famous Tuskegee Institute in Alabama. His first building, Science Hall, was built entirely by students under his direction, all the way down to the manufacturing of the bricks. Several years thereafter, Washington and Taylor began to work with Julius Rosenwald, the president of Sears and Roebuck and Company, who had pledged part of his department store fortune to help finance more than 5,000 schools for black children across the South, many of which were designed by my great-grandfather. Taylor's son, my grandfather, Robert Roshan Taylor, didn't start out in life quite as diligent. Raised in Tuskegee, he was sent to Howard Academy, the renowned boarding school affiliated with Howard University, only to be expelled for what has been described to me as a youthful impropriety. To teach him a lesson, his father made him work for 3 years at a sawmill he'd designed in Opelika, Alabama. The lesson apparently worked, because from there my grandfather went on to graduate from the University of Illinois with a degree in business administration. By then, he shared his father's keen appreciation for the value of a good education. By 1929, my grandfather had joined the family profession, partnering with Julius Rosenwald in planning, building, and eventually managing a massive apartment complex between 46th Street and 47th along Michigan Avenue in a black neighborhood known as Bronzeville on the south side of Chicago. Its official name was Michigan Boulevard Garden Apartments, but everyone called it the Rosenwald Building. With over 400 beautiful yet affordable units, it soon became a coveted address for black Chicagoans, from Pullman porters and postal workers to doctors and lawyers. It had its share of celebrity residents as well. Musicians like Nat King Cole and Quincy Jones, the poet Gwendolyn Brooks, and heavyweight boxing champion Joe Louis. As a manager of the Rosenwald Building, my grandfather raised his two daughters there along with his wife, the matriarch of our clan, Laura Dorothy Vaughn Jennings, my grandmother Puddin'. Short for pudding, it was a nickname bestowed on her by my father because, he said, she was so sweet. Puddin' was born in Berkeley, California. After her father died when she was 5, her mother moved the family briefly to Louisville, Kentucky, to live with her late husband's mother. They did not get along, so she finally settled in Chicago. Puddin's mother raised her and her 2 siblings, Mormon and Ulsa Alone, on her own, working as a clerk at the Chicago Board of Education and taking in fine sewing and needlepoint at night. At that time, racially restrictive covenants confined black Chicagoans to neighborhoods like Bronzeville, where the Rosenwald Building was located. But in 1948, the legality of those covenants was struck down by the Supreme Court, and slowly, black families began moving out. In 1957, after my grandfather died, Puddin' decided to move out of the Rosenwald building and buy an apartment building with her daughter, my Aunt Larinita Dugas, and Aunt Larinita's husband, Lester Dugas. It was at 5000 South Woodlawn, just 2 miles away from the Rosenwald building, in the neighborhood of South Kenwood. At the time, Aunt Larinita and Uncle Lester had 2.5 children, Gail, Jeffrey, and Lauren on the way. The building had 2 units on the first floor that they leased out and 2 units on the second floor, secured by a locked door at the bottom of the stairs. So Puddin' and the Dugases usually left the door open between their 2 apartments. South Kenwood was, at the time, a largely white neighborhood surrounded by Lake Michigan on one side and low-income black communities on all others. As more black families began to move in, white families started to move out. The process sped up exponentially during the unrest of the Civil Rights era, as unscrupulous real estate brokers, known as blockbusters, started canvassing the neighborhood, exploiting white homeowners' fears of racial turnover, and convincing them to sell their houses at below market rates so that blockbusters could then flip them to black families at inflated prices using predatory financing. When that happened, property values fell and businesses moved out. The same process was playing out in the adjoining area of Hyde Park, home to the University of Chicago. White flight became so prevalent that at one point, the university considered moving out of the city and into the suburbs. It decided to stay, perhaps in part because the city acquired tracts of land that buffered the campus as a part of urban renewal initiatives and gave them to the university. The land grab, which is really what it was, helped stabilize the neighborhood, but it caused a rift between the university and many of its displaced residents and community leaders that has taken decades to bridge. The university and a coalition of progressive homeowners and politicians wanted to see Hyde Park South Kenwood become an inclusive and racially integrated community. Leon Dupre, the alderman representing the ward, was so liberal that when muggers shot him twice in the leg, he didn't press charges because he blamed the criminals' actions on the larger societal factors that had shaped them. This was in stark contrast to most of Chicago, where racism and discrimination was still prevalent. Fortunately for us, my father's new job included assistance in financing a spacious apartment in Madison Park, a gorgeous 2-block enclave in South Kenwood, just a block and a half from Puddin' and the Dugas family. Then, 5 years later, my parents were able to afford their dream house 3 blocks from Madison Park on Greenwood Avenue, a wide and leafy street of landmarked single-family homes, many dating back to the 1800s. Ours was the smallest house on the block, but I loved it, especially the circular staircase in the front, whose banister my cousins and I took turns sliding down, and the large backyard where my parents have hosted countless occasions. South Kenwood was also home to several members of my mother's large and welcoming clan. Puddin's Woodlawn home was always the hub of activity. If any of our parents were running late from work, or if we were sick during a school day, she was always right there, sitting in her favorite chair next to the window in her little front room, visible from the street. The same day we moved into our home on Greenwood, one of my cousins, Ann Cook, moved into an apartment a block away with her 4 children. The Dibbles, Ann's brother Gene and his wife Jeanette, and their 5 kids, lived across the park from our old apartment in Madison Park. Our cousin Bill Feynman, his wife Nancy, and their 4 kids were 3 blocks away. And Jewel LaFontant, who was a cousin of a cousin, lived with her son and my lifelong friend, John Rogers, at the corner of our block. Jewel was the first black deputy solicitor general under President Richard Nixon. She was our family's 1 Republican and our block on Greenwood, where the Obamas now also have a home today, bears Jewel's name on an honorary street sign. In all, 16 cousins in my generation lived within the radius of just a few blocks, including 4 girls who were all my age. I grew up in an era where parents didn't believe in programming much of their children's time. After my chores on a weekend morning, my parents would open the door and say, "Find your cousins." And I would. Our parents also didn't believe in much pampering either. If I returned home in tears after an argument with a cousin or a friend,